Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Coming up on the program this week, we're going to talk about financial literacy and in particular, a new free online course from McGill University. Professor Isabel Bea Besnenu is Dean of McGill University's Desotel Faculty of Management. She will be here. Then, maximizing your credit card points while you shop. Rashika Tabi, CEO of Brim Financial, will be here to tell us about the different ways to use credit cards to help you save money. And the cost of being part of a sports team can really add up. Fundraising can be an option, but that's a lot of work. Mark Bachman is the CEO of FlipGive, and he's going to be here to tell us more about an app that makes raising funds for your team a little easier. Plus, transitioning into retirement. Carol Bazaar will be here to tell us about that process of converting the RSP into the RIF. She is the Vice President of Tax, Estate, and Strategic Philanthropy at McKenzie Investments. And we'll talk to Jason Pereira, Senior Financial Consultant at Woodgate Financial, about the new Financial Planning Association of Canada. Do we really need another association? I'll ask him why. All that is ahead. Let's get started. Learning how to take charge of your personal finances is an important skill to have at any age. It's one of the reasons why McGill University has collaborated with RBC Future Launch and the Globe and Mail to offer something called McGill Personal Finance Essentials, a series of modules, a whole curriculum that'll teach you the basics of personal finance. Joining us now to tell us more about this program is Professor Isabel Bea Besnenu, Dean of McGill University's Desotel Faculty of Management. She joins us from Montreal. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
What is the Personal Financial Essentials program and how can users learn from it?
Sure. So this is a program that is free, that is available online to all Canadians. The only thing people need to know is to go on the web, type mcgillpersonalfinance.com and register for the program.
I talk about and think about personal finance and financial literacy all the time. So it would make sense that I would be very interested in this. Why was it interesting to you?
Indeed. Well, first of all, Bruce, you should register for it.
I should. I wish I'd had time to complete it. Then I was thinking you could quiz me and see how I did.
A lot of time.
Yeah.
So these are 8 different modules of 15 to 25 minutes each. And we're teaching there with 8 different professors from McGill University the basics of personal finance.
And when you say the basics, what does that mean to you? So you teach the first module. It's the introduction to personal finance. What are some of the things that you cover there?
So the first module is really an introductory model. And this is about why it's important to learn about personal finance and introducing all the professors that are going to teach all of the different modules and what's going to be covered there. And what's going to be covered is some basics on debt and borrowing, money, today, tomorrow, strategy budgeting, the art of investing, some notions of real estate and investing in real estate, and then behavioral finance.
Mm. How do you test people on their engagement with the material? Are there multiple choice quizzes? Do you finish with a report card? If I do it, am I going to feel better about myself or worse about myself?
Well, I hope you'll feel better about yourself. So at the end of each module, there's a short quiz that is multiple choice questions. And when you completed all of the different modules, you get a certificate of completion from McGill University.
Interesting. And how big do you think this is going to be? I wanted to do this interview because it's unlike anything I've seen. There's tons of material out there. There's tons of books. But there isn't something like this done under the auspices of a university. How many people do you think you're going to get in the first year?
Well, I can tell you how many we got already. So we launched the program on November 1st. And as of today, we have more than 25,000 people who registered for the
wow.
program.
It's amazing. Now, I mentioned the partnerships, RBC Future Launch and the Globe and Mail. The Globe and Mail is easy. They're a storied publication in this country. RBC is a massive bank. And one of the things I talk about, and I talk about it with bankers, I talk about it with the Canadian Banking Association, I talk about it a lot, is the inherent conflict of interest that exists between pure financial literacy and the interests of the banks. And the easiest examples are around credit card interest and the profit that banks make on that, and investment fees. How do you address those inherent conflicts in the material?
So you're very right in saying that. And what was really important in the project is that in terms of the content, all of the content has been developed by McGill University. RBC was not part of it in any way. And we're very serious about the academic freedom and the fact that the professors are teaching what they think is most important. And this is all coming from the professors.
Mm. So how did you address within the curriculum credit cards in particular? Because one of the things that annoys me, makes me crazy, is how the CBA talks about credit cards as really an enabler to consumerism, and nowhere in their literature do they talk about the consequence of people's credit card use in the form of overspending or the cost to carry an outstanding balance. How do you address those in this program?
So I mentioned earlier that there is a module that is called behavioral finance, and I can give you an example of what is said there in terms of the credit cards, for example. The behavior of consumers is very often that they want to save for whatever reason, but then at the same time, they keep a large balance on their credit card. And obviously, they're paying very large interest on their credit card while saving earns very little interest.
Yeah.
So this is something that is a psychological effect, and we're trying to get people to understand that this is not the best financial decision.
Your course is open 4 times a year, which I thought was interesting. Why did you decide to do it that way instead of making it available so someone can take it at any time?
Well, we thought it would be create a sense of a cohort by opening that course several times a year, and it's just a sense of creating some kind of a community within the course.
Now, you have obviously an extraordinary pool of young people who can engage in the curriculum. How did you test it to ensure that it was resonant and helpful and on point? Did you put students from Des Hôtels through the program first?
Well, we didn't need to. You know, these are professors, so they're in contact with students and all of these young adult population all the time. So they know exactly what is needed and what the students need to learn.
How do you think about, as the dean of a business school, how do you think about this move towards online learning? There's MOOCs, the massive open courses that are around there, and it really is changing higher education in lots of different ways. This is one example of delivery in a bit of a different way. Broadly speaking, how do you think about online learning? What's its role? I don't think anyone's saying it will ever replace traditional in-class, but it's certainly shifting the dynamics a bit.
I agree. So this is not a course, first of all. This is a program that is put, this is a course that is put available, you know, highly accessible to the general population. So we're not trying to deliver a diploma in any way. And at the end, the participants do not get any degree or diploma from that. So your question is a little larger than that in terms of online learning. And I agree that some schools are going more in that direction, but at the end of the day, the students like to be in the classroom, and the students like to have this sense of community that they form in the classroom, and the experience that they're getting in universities are still very important to them. So it's about finding the right balance between online education and in-person education, and making sure that technology is helping students in their learning and not diverting them from that.
Very interesting stuff. Well, best of luck with it, Professor. Thank you so much for joining us to tell us about it.
Thank you so much, Bruce, for having me today.
We're talking about the McGill Personal Finance Essentials, which is a series of modules that'll teach you the basics of personal finance. We were joined by Professor Isabelle Bégeux-Besnenou. She is Dean of McGill University's Des Hôtels Faculty of Management.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
You'll be forgiven if you don't completely understand the various designations and associations in the world of financial advice. Advocates, FP Canada, the MFDA, IROC, CFP, CIM, FMA, PFP, blah, blah, blah. There are so many of them. Well, there is now another one that has just entered the picture. It's called the Financial Planning Association of Canada, or FPAC, and it has created standards for its members to follow that focus on improving their relationships with Canadians to help them meet their financial goals. Joining us now to tell us more about the association is Jason Pereira. He is a senior financial consultant at Woodgate Financial. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce.
Why do we need another one?
What a surprise. It's the first question I get to answer every time.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So I think it comes down to we look at the landscape that exists, and we also look at what this association stands for. So the landscape that exists, there's really three players we're talking about, in my opinion. The first is the largest abacus, which is predominantly dominated by the insurance market. So different values, different goals there. Another one's the CIPFS, which is largely focused on continuing education and not what we're focusing on. The third is I have a lot of respect for and I'm actually on the board for, which is the IAFP, which is specifically for practicing financial planners. They have to actually produce financial plans that are vetted. Where FPAC, or the Financial Planning Association of Canada, basically is different is we want to be a broader audience that takes planners who are looking to become true professionals. What I mean by that is we are predominantly an industry that is born out of the product, out of product sales, and still kind of mired by that. When you look at what other professions have in place in terms of an ecosystem, in terms of support structures, regulation, different standards for eBay altogether, we are lacking that because we've only been around for about 50 years. So we're trying to fast forward that as much as possible. And when I say we're different, we've literally spelled out exactly what we want to create as an end state to financial planning in this country. And that's basically the highest level possible imaginable. And not just saying that that's our end state. If you're going to join this association, from day one, you are taking a pledge to act as a fiduciary to your client. No one else does that. Mm. Secondly, they have 24 months to basically convert their practice to one of greater transparency and greater evidence. So what I mean by that is, you know, when it comes to disclosure of compensation, even though we've had regulatory change on that, it's incomplete. Not everything is disclosed. We want basically plain English disclosure in writing and in dollars and percentages every year.
Why did you position yourself as what seems to me as just another association instead of this is the gold standard, this is the good housekeeping seal of approval, this is raising the bar? Because none of that in your materials comes through.
Well, thank you for the constructive criticism.
Yeah,
I will go back and rewrite the material. Thank you. And I need to hit that note more seriously. But that is exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to basically create a world that says that, hey, if your advisor is not a part of this association, you better be asking them why not. Because what is it they don't believe in? They do not believe in acting as a fiduciary on your behalf, which means putting your needs ahead of theirs at all times with the highest legal standard. Do they not believe in pure and full transparency of all costs and all considerations? Do they not believe in taking an evidence-based approach to how they advise you as opposed to using heuristics and rules of thumb? Like, what is it that they're not believing in?
So there's the values piece, which you speak of passionately and eloquently.
Thank you. There's also
credentialing, of which you have like every credential out there.
I looked at your
LinkedIn profile and you've got everything. But not all financial advisors do. And there are some extraordinary financial advisors who don't have all the letters at the end of their name, as you have. What is the minimum? What's the barrier to entry?
We basically looked at it as and this is an important time because a lot of provinces are looking at legislating what the minimum standard is. So we looked at it as the gold standard around the world is the CFP, right?
Yep.
So if anyone else is going to be considered a financial planner or going to be used to be able to call themselves a financial planner, that should be the standard across the world for consumer protection from my standpoint. Also because it's probably the most comprehensive of them. Then we looked at it and said, what else is there that's above that or similar? And in the province of Quebec, you have to be certified as a plan fin or a planner financial. I'm going to butcher that if I try it in French.
Yep.
But that is a legal mandate. So we included them as well because, frankly, those are the only people who qualify for financial planning. And that's actually one of the highest standards in the world.
Why didn't you just go into what is now called FP Canada, the former Financial Planning Standards Council, shake it up and raise the standards? Why did you launch a new thing?
Because FP Canada is not a member association. This confuses a lot of people. They are a designating body. They issue designations. They are not an association that people opt into and then drive the agenda from their angle. And we've talked to them, and you know what? Frankly, they've got a they're open to collaboration, and I hope that that's going to be the way we're going to work going forward.
And the comparison you'd give is the Canadian Medical Association is akin to what you're doing, and the College of Physicians and Surgeons is akin to what the what FP Canada does.
Exactly. And this model actually exists in the U.S., where the CFP board issues the CFP in the U.S., and the Financial Planning Association in the U.S. Is the largest member body. There's a couple other ones, but they have in large part driven the agenda in many times in history, including suing their own regulators.
How did this start? Did someone have an idea and you said, let's go for, I don't know, Cosmos in a fancy hotel and talk about this? Or is it, I don't know, someone's basement or backyard?
That would have been a less frustrating story. In actuality, it came from the frustration of many of us. And it kind of sparked after myself coming back from one of many conferences in the U.S. where I come, the only time I ever come back to Canada ashamed of my homeland is when I go to conferences in the U.S. and I talk to advisors around the world and see how behind we are in terms of development and consumer protection and moving the industry forward. And, you know, coming back and speaking to many people felt the same way. We started saying, you know what, enough's enough. What are we going to do? Like, what are we, enough talk. What are we actually going to do to make this better? And we didn't want to start an association. We didn't set out to do that. But when we started talking about what was going to be necessary, the only thing that was going to do it was a new association. That's where it came from.
Do most of your current members offer a fee-only option?
No, it is a mix. There is one of the things that is not permitted is the sale of anything involving a deferred deferred sales charge.
Yep.
So you are basically, there's fee only, there is fee based on charging as a percentage of AUM, and there's hybrids of both. But one of the things that's going to be, that's a requirement is complete and total transparency in plain English and numbers.
What is the requirement to be a member of the association in terms of a financial plan? Because one of the things that I see all the time are financial advisors, and they're great financial advisors. There's not a knock about the sector, but they focus on investment advice.
Yep.
And even the sophistication may be extraordinary, but it's not grounded in a financial plan. Is that a barrier to entry?
That is not a barrier to entry for us because we recognize that deficiency as well in the industry. So there's already the IFP, the Institute for Advanced Financial Planners, already is kind of the body for those who are not only producing financial plans but doing so at a high level. This body is aiming to get everybody to that level. So let's take on, because a lot of times I hear, and I've won awards for this sort of thing in the past. I do a lot of public stuff for financial planning. And a lot of times I have people come to me saying, like, I don't know how to properly integrate this in here, or I have a deficiency in this area of my knowledge base. So we're trying to give them the resources and the tools and the coaching to get them to a level where, yes, that is absolutely there. And one of the things that we mandated is they need to take a comprehensive look at the client's life. There's no such thing as saying, well, I don't do insurance or I don't do tax planning. Right. If you don't, find someone who does and work in collaboration, because this is not about what you do. It's about what the client needs.
What's the ideal end state? Is it that, because there are tens of thousands of people who call themselves financial planners in this country, tens and tens of thousands. Is it that those tens and tens of thousands of people raise their standard, or that the consumers recognize the difference in the quality of services they receive, and those who are a part of your association do BAFO business, and those who aren't eventually, you know, choose a different career path because they can't make a go of it?
I think you kind of nailed it from both angles. Basically, we want to be the ones out there saying, hey, this is what we stand for. If you're not part of us, then why not? And the clients and the individual consumers need to recognize this. And as they do that, we want to attract more and more of the right type of advisors. Not all of them are going to want to join us. Not all of them are going to want to increase that standard. Around the world, every time standards have been increased, you've had an exiting of advisors who just aren't willing to do it because of the career stage. So we want to get to the point where the reality is where a consumer can walk in and deal with the financial planner at some point in the future and with confidence know that they are going to be, they can expect to receive comprehensive planning services as defined by the financial planning bodies that exist at a level of proficiency that is going to help them and is not just there to sell them a product.
Well, I love your passion, Jason, and I wish you the best of luck on this. I will say you need a new name. It needs to be some made-up word like Belogatex or, I don't know, some new word that stands out. Financial Planning Association of Canada. All right. You're going to have to come back and talk to me about your rebranding later. Jason Pereira, Senior Financial Consultant at Woodgate Financial. So much on this topic and so much to be done to elevate the level of service that Canadians can expect. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, maximizing your credit card points. A new player called Brim Financial is on the scene. Rasha Katabi will be our guest. Then later in the program, how to convert your RSP into a riff. Carol Bazaire is Vice President of Tax, Estate, and Strategic Philanthropy at McKenzie Investments. If you'd like to send us a note or provide a comment, you can do that old school on email, ask@moolala.ca, on social, @BruceSelry, Twitter, BruceSelry, Moolala. There's also a newsletter for Moolala. It brings together all the content that I do on Prosper, the Financial Advisors podcast, plus columns from CBC Radio, CityLine, all that. You can sign up at moolala.ca. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Canadians love their credit cards, and they love credit card points even more. Loyalty programs in this country are among the most successful in the world. But how do you make the most out of yours? Rasha Khattabi is the CEO of Brim Financial. She's here now to talk about some different ways Canadian consumers can use credit cards and credit card points to their advantage while shopping. Hello there.
Hi.
Now, your view on this topic is going to be informed by your business. Your business is called Brim, so I should probably know how it works, just so I can ask the right pointed questions.
Absolutely. Okay, so with your Brim card, it's a fully open platform, which means that any merchant in Canada or in the world really can contact us, and within 3 minutes, you have rewards offered that are up and live on all Brim credit cards. So by using your Brim cards, you're actually earning 3, 5, 8, 10, 15, up to 25 points per dollar spent, something we've never heard of in the context of credit cards.
So is this a card that I would use instead of the card that's currently in my wallet?
Yes, that would be the only card you would use, because that is the best shopping credit card there is. We now have launched with 130 merchants. We're going to have 200 merchants by January. And the amount of traction we're getting from merchants is quite unbelievable.
I can see for a merchant, especially smaller merchants, am I right to say there's a lot of smaller merchants who are jazzed about it? Why would a large merchant do it instead of having a loyalty program that they fund themselves?
Because from a consumer's perspective, so their customers, the people that, you know, they care about satisfying, so for them to come back, how useful is it for me to have $5 on this program and $10 at this merchant and $7 here and et cetera?
But in that way, it's analogous to the Air Miles program, which is available to many, 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 many different merchants.
Yeah. However, I think that's how Air Miles started with that concept. I think the execution of that concept in the context of Air Miles probably left a lot to be desired. There's a lot of friction between merchants and Air Miles, and you see it, you know, quite frankly, even in the new application that they just launched a few days ago. The value that trickles down to the consumer, so again, sort of a trickle-down economy type of concept, is crumbs. It's super little, because you have very
Say for 3 years and you get enough for a kettle.
Exactly. Exactly.
Like, I got a kettle. I qualify for a kettle. So how many years does it take with the Brim card to qualify for the same kettle?
Probably a week worth of shopping.
Where you drop $1,000.
Well, and because you're getting not 2 points or 3 points, you're getting 8 and 10 and 15 and 20 and 25. So you can see how you can accumulate your points way faster.
How does it work that you're able to provide what you say, and I don't have the data to check you on this, that you can provide more to the consumer than those other loyalty programs? Are you bending the time-space continuum? A little bit. She's nodding. Listeners, she's nodding here, smiling and nodding. How do you do it?
Okay. So, you know, we've basically changed the game. We changed the way that space works. So we built from inside Brim, from inside your credit card, a live bridge to all merchants worldwide that is live right now. So even a merchant in Iceland could contact us, and within, you know, half a day, everything's up and running on Brim. So, but it's a very important concept, this direct bridge to merchants, because what it did is that it took out the middle person. It took out the Air Miles. Mm. It took out all of the large loyalty companies that for them to exist, well, they're going to have to take their revenue and their profitability from somewhere. Well, they take it from the merchant and from what they could have passed on to you. Whereas on the Brim platform, as I said, there is no middleman. It is from your credit card infrastructure directly to all merchants. So they have no friction cost. Everything that they want to put out as rewards for consumers goes directly to the consumer. So you can see how the offers on your Brim card are by far and not even close the richest you can have in the market. And we're rolling out to hotels, to rental car companies. We just onboarded 3 airlines and we're going into all of the segments. So basically your Brim card is not only your best shopping card, it's your best travel card. It has zero foreign exchange transaction fees, which is how much banks and credit cards charge you on top of the base rate. And from a base rate perspective, we challenge you to get a better exchange rate anywhere. You have banked with this branch for 20 years. You are their best customer. They will never give you a rate as good as on your Brim MasterCard.
So we have spent way more time on Brim than I ever would have imagined, but I'm interested in it. I should tell you, I don't like loyalty programs. Mm-hmm. And the reason I don't like them is because I think often they force consumers to behave irrationally.
Correct.
So instead of going to the cheapest place to buy the deodorant and the shampoo, you go to the big chain because it's double points day and you end up spending $50 on more stuff than you necessarily need. As a former marketer, I completely get it. Hooray for that. But as an advocate for the consumer who's trying to get a handle on their money, I don't like them. Me no like these things. So how do you defend your industry's push to getting Canadians to spend money that they do not have for things that they may well need? I'm not saying that you're getting them to buy cruises or anything, but they're buying more and paying more for things because of this glassy-eyed Canadian obsession with points.
You know what? Actually, I see it a bit differently. When I'm being able to get 8, 10, 15, 25 points per dollar that I spent, that's 8, 10, 15, 25% off of what I'm spending. And what we focused on building in the marketplace of Brim is basically all of the goods and services and merchants that you would go to in your everyday life. It's not just aspirational. So whether it is I'm buying my deodorants or toilet paper from well.ca and it's online, or whether it is I'm buying a book from Indigo or workout clothes from Lululemon, or it's all on Brim Marketplace and it's all at tremendous value and it's right in your credit card and you don't have to go and coupon and etc.
Are you akin to the Visas and the MasterCards that make their money on that interchange fee, or are you akin to the bank that makes your money on people having an outstanding balance?
We're an issuer, so we're more like the bank.
You're quite happy with people, I'm using air quotes here, you're quite happy with people not paying their credit card off in full?
No, because there's also the potential for credit risk and losses and etc.
But at the margins.
At the margins. But when you're having losses like that and you're a startup company, it's not like you have the you're not looking forward to these losses.
No, I understand. There is no business benefit to Brim to having every single client pay their credit card off in full every single month.
Oh, no. Actually, more than 80% of Brim card users pay their card in full every month. So Brim has a very sustainable, very solid business model, and that is what it goes for. So, of course, we offer credit and we support, any revolving balance you may have. But the bulk of the business of Brim actually is with those people that keep current on their bills and pay their bills and etc. We even have budgeting embedded on the platform. It helps you keep track of your every category, even the target, the goal that you put for yourself this month is very much right in front of you. We want you to stay on track.
Is your background in financial services?
Yes.
Is a part of your drive to have this business be successful a bit of a against the industry that you have left? It sounds like you're deeply passionate about it and you derive great pleasure from being a disruptor. Have I read you correctly?
I derive great pleasure from being a disruptor to make things better. I know that there is a massive margin and massive room to make things better for the Canadian consumers, and they deserve it. And we can actually build it in a better way. That's exactly what we set out to do at Brim. We went out to build it in a better way for the Canadian consumers. Everyone that has a Brim card is benefiting today, so go get yours, and then you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And for merchants as well, we democratize the access to a state of
I don't
of
care
the
about
art.
Merchants. You can care about merchants. I don't care about merchants.
You know, the small merchants support our economy.
Small business owners, fair. Why I say that, and I say it tongue-in-cheek, what I really am speaking up for, and I really appreciate your eloquent defense of your model, I'm speaking up for Canadians.
Yes.
So be good to them, okay?
We are. We look forward to dealing with them.
Rasha, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rasha Kitabi, CEO of Brim Financial. Stay with us. Coming up next, Carol Belzaire, the Vice President of Tax, Estate, and Strategic Philanthropy at Mackenzie Investments. She'll be here to talk about the conversion process from your RRSP to your RIF. And later, Carol will be back to go through the Moolala questionnaire. Now, you never have to miss an episode of Moolala ever again. They're all at moolala.ca. They're all at your podcast platform. So go to one of the platforms, download the full show, download a segment, review, subscribe, blah, blah, blah. More blah, blah, blah when we come back after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We talk a lot, like a lot, about saving for retirement. How much to save, where to invest, how to minimize or defer your taxes, blah, blah, blah. But we don't talk nearly enough about what happens in retirement when you're no longer accumulating, you are decumulating. And one part of this for many Canadians is going to be the conversion of their RRSP into a RIF, a process that's mandatory by the time you hit 71. Carol Bazaar is Vice President, Tax, Estate, and Strategic Philanthropy at Mackenzie Investments. She joins us now to talk about this transition. Ooh, I like that, like a caterpillar to a butterfly. Hello, Carol.
Hello, Bruce.
I don't know if that metaphor works. Let's say that it does.
I don't know.
I like it. So let's start with the mechanics here. Someone's been accumulating for years and years and years. They've built up their RRSP, and then ta-da, they hit a magical age. How does this work?
What happens, Bruce, is you have to open a new account. So you've got your RRSP. Now you have to open a RIF because it's on a different system. With a RIF, you can no longer contribute. So you have to do the paperwork, you have to name your beneficiaries again, and then the RIF starts to figure out for you every year how much you have to take out and get taxed on.
So if I'm completely asleep at the wheel, will whatever investment company I'm with do that conversion? Will someone show up at my house and say, hey, you got to sign this paperwork, this has to happen?
No, you'll get a letter.
I'll get a letter, but I should be a bit more proactive than that.
Oh, totally, yeah. Because you want to make sure that, especially we talk about working with your advisor is going to look at that. It's all part of your retirement plan. How much do you need? How much do you want in retirement? Let's get your RIF going for you.
So when it is converted, it's still going to be in my online banking profile. I'm still going to get statements. All that will be the same. It's
correct.
Just a different structure. Now, you talk about the minimums. Let's go through what the minimums are and what the default is that they're going to start cutting me a check for if I'm not proactive about it.
Okay, so the withdrawals are based on your age and the value of your plan at the beginning of January. So there's a calculator, and all of the RIF providers take care of that for you. So it's based on a percentage under the Income Tax Act. So, for example, if you're age 71 and you open your RIF, you're not going to get anything this year. But starting January next year, at the age of 71, at the beginning of January, you're going to get have to take 5.28% of the balance of your RIF.
Gotcha. So that balance would change over time, but that is the percentage. And again, if I'm asleep at the wheel and I'm invested entirely in individual stocks, for example, what's the investment firm going to do? Are they going to start selling my shares and cutting me a check? Yeah,
absolutely. They'll have to get the cash flow. So they will sell enough to make the payment out.
Does the payment come annually or by default? Does it come annually?
You can choose. But what most people do in retirement, because you're used to having a paycheck.
Yeah.
So make your RIF act like your paycheck. So if you get government money at the end of the month, maybe take your RIF paycheck on the 15th of the month.
What are some of the what's the rationale for people taking more than that minimum? And I know I'm opening a can of worms here, because one of the things that many retirees have to sort out, especially those who are just retiring, they've been in the world long enough that their TFSA could be a material part of their retirement savings,
right,
company pension, all that stuff. Give us the case to, or I guess the thinking that needs to be done to find out, you know, maybe you chew through that RIF much faster because of these kinds of reasons.
Okay. So, Bruce, one of the reasons would be that maybe, like me, you don't have a spouse.
Mm.
So I likely, when I convert my RSP to a RIF, would take more than the minimum, because if I pass away, it's all taxable all at one time.
Right.
So I would take out more. Maybe it's a lifestyle choice that this is, you know, you in retirement, a couple want to take off and travel, or somebody wants to travel. They've got things they want to do, might take more than the minimum while they're early in their retirement, and then they can default back to the minimum later on.
How do you determine what you withdraw where? So I mentioned the TFSA, but in addition to that, a lot of people have non-registered investments.
Right.
And there's a
right.
there's a big tax question here about what the optimal balance is.
Exactly. So that's where it comes into the tax planning. What have you got? Where are you holding it? So if you're going to if you're riffing and maybe you've got old age security, you want to hold dividend paying stocks in your RIF, not your non-reg. Because the gross-up value of your dividend is what will trigger the OAS clawback. Interest income is highly taxed. Hold that in your RIF. Mm. But then as to where you take the money out, you want to be able to plan your taxes so you minimize the tax. So maybe it's minimal RIF. Non-reg, you're going to get capital gains or capital losses. So you might want to utilize that. And many people I'm finding, Bruce, are keeping the TFSA as kind of their own insurance policy.
Right. Because the tax, it's after-tax income that went in there, and it's mm-hmm. tax-free as it grows, so it gives you some more flexibility. Now, a lot of seniors, just the mention of the acronym RIF gets them very, very feisty. Mm-hmm. What's the source of their annoyance? Is it that they feel like they have to take too big a withdrawal?
The source of the annoyance actually is that they have to start generating the taxable income,
mm.
especially for a lot of people who continue to work after the age of 71. They're going to lose all that money to tax. So the age of 71 is simply a government rule, because the government doesn't want to wait to get the tax revenue forever through your when you're saving for your retirement. So they said, okay, 71, we want you to start taking the money. But a lot of people will take their RIF payment, pay tax on it, and top up, throw it into their TFSA if they don't need it.
Mm. What happens to a RIF upon death? You mentioned if you don't have a spouse, there is a different dynamic than if you do.
Mm-hmm. So with a RIF or with an RSP, anything like that, the RIF of the deceased spouse can be rolled tax deferred over to a surviving spouse.
Right.
Or another qualified beneficiary. If you have a financially dependent minor grandchild, maybe, or a financially dependent disabled child or grandchild, you can roll that into either an RDSP, Registered Disability Savings Plan, on a tax deferral, or into an RSP for them. And then the tax burden goes to them.
And if in the case where that isn't your circumstance, the RIF then becomes a part of the state, I assume that is it deemed sold, and then in the final tax return that income gets declared and taxed?
Right. It's called deemed disposed. So the value the day before you pass, like the evening of the day before you die, that's the value that gets taken 100% into your income on your final tax return. So if it's quite large, you can lose in Ontario 53.5% of it to tax, which leaves less for your estate.
There is so much discussion in in Canada these days about the role of full service advisors, robo advisors, fee only, fee based, all that kind of stuff. And there is a very compelling case to be made on accumulation that it's tough for advisors to prove the value of their worth. It seems a whole heck of a lot easier to prove your value when you're talking about decumulation.
Oh, totally. Because then it becomes a tax conversation with your client. It also becomes an estate planning conversation with your client. What do you want done with your RIF now? Because in the accumulation stage, as you know, Bruce, it's like people are busy saving, saving, saving.
Yeah.
Now it comes to what makes sense for me to take this money out? Should I take more? Should I base the RIF payments, which you can do, on a younger spouse so that it lasts longer and you take out less? So there are a few things that advisors can help with that maybe a robo-advisor doesn't have a tip on, something like that.
Yeah, very interesting. Carol, thank you for your time and your insight.
Oh, thank you so much for the opportunity, Bruce.
Take care. Carol Bazaar, the Vice President of Tax, Estate, and Strategic Philanthropy at McKenzie Investments. Our focus was on decumulation, and in particular, when it's time to convert that RSP to a RIF. Stay with us. Coming up next, Mark Bachman is here to talk about an app called FlipGive. If you have kids, you've probably heard about this one because I'm certainly getting these emails. A different way of fundraising for kids' sports teams, for example, that isn't going around selling cookie dough and magazine subscriptions. Stay with us. Carol Bazaar will be back to answer the Moolala questionnaire. If you want to listen to some more of our Moolala segments, check on out or go on out. Go on out. Is that a phrase? Go on over to moolala.ca, your podcast platform, for full shows or individual segments. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Whether you're part of a sports team or your kid's part of a sports team, recreationally, competitively, the costs associated with participating can be expensive. There's uniforms, there's equipment, there's travel. It can really, really add up. And instead of spending your time organizing a car wash or a bake sale or selling magazine subscriptions or cookie dough or whatever it is to raise money, there is another way to earn some cash for these activities in through an app called FlipGive. Joining us now to talk more about this idea is the CEO of the company, Mark Bachman. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
We're having this conversation because my daughter is a synchronized swimmer, and I got that email. You know, the one who's like, we're going to fundraise, and it turns out they're using FlipGive. So tell me what it is and how it works.
For sure. So FlipGive is a new and free team fundraising application, and we help parents raise money and offset the cost of their youth sports activity just by basically shopping online and using their everyday spend.
So is it a browser extension, or are you shopping on FlipGive for things? How does it work?
So the first thing a team needs to do is come in and create an account on FlipGive. So if you're on the web, that will be a page on FlipGive, or if you're in the app, it's basically you've got an account on the FlipGive app. Then the first thing you do is invite all the parents to come in and create accounts. So they create an account. They're affiliated with that with your team. Then every time a parent shops through the app at popular retailers, we track that, and it earns cash back that gets pooled towards the team just by purchasing things that you're gonna buy anyway.
And where does that cash come from? Is it from the retailer?
So FlipGive is totally free for the teams and parents. And where we get paid is these retailers and merchants are basically paying advertising and marketing dollars out to be able to acquire customers to come to their site. And we use those marketing dollars to be able to go and fund the cash back for the teams.
Help put this into context from a fundraising perspective. Let's say, what would be an example of, is there a grocery retailer that you could affiliate yourself with?
Well, actually, so in Canada, you can shop at Whole Foods through Amazon. But right now, we're working with different retailers, gas, coffee, restaurants.
Okay, let's use gas as an example. So say you're a commuter and you use a tank of gas every week. So that's $200 a month, let's say. 4 times 50, $200 a month. Yeah. What percentage would go to the synchronized swim team from that $200? What's the right way to think about that?
You got it. So we work with Esso, and there's actually two programs that we have with Esso. One is you can come in and purchase a fuel discount voucher, and that gives you, like, you know, you're basically pre-buying a discount off gas, and every $50 fuel voucher that you purchase gives $15 back to your team. And then on top of that, as you you can buy gift cards to be able that you'll use at Esso, and 2% of all your gas gift card spend basically goes back to your team.
So for $200, that's $4.
$4 plus what you'd earn on the fuel savings side of things.
Gotcha.
You end up with, you know, 15 families throughout an entire season, it really adds up.
Do you have a way? I'm sure one of the stories you're trying to get out there is for the teams to adopt this platform as a way to raise money. How do you quantify the opportunity in dollar terms so that they can see if it's going to be worth doing this instead of the bake sale or the whatever else they've done in the past?
So actually, the way that we position this is teams need all the help they can get. So, you still may have to go out for sponsorships, and you still may have to have some events. We think about this as one tool in the toolbox. And the nice thing about this is there's no selling involved. So this is, like, really a passive program. You're using the existing shopping spend that you would have throughout the year. And it's one more easy way to add dollars back on top of that. I would suggest that it's pretty easy for every family that participates to raise, you know, a few hundred dollars. So, you know, with a team of active parents over the course of the season, you know, $1,500 to $2,000, hopefully it saves you from, you know, having to sell pepperoni sticks to your neighbors, or it saves you for one other sort of more onerous time-consuming.
Pepperoni sticks, no thank you very much. Now, you've also got a donation feature. How does that work?
Yeah, so teams can also use, if someone wants to support the team and doesn't want to purchase anything, they can also give a donation. So we do it more as a convenience. 99% of all the transactions on FlipGive are really shopping related, but we just try to make it easy. So you can basically make a donation. It goes right through the team. We actually charge, there's a charge to the donor of 6%, which is 3% covers the credit card processing fees and 3% covers the admin fees. And then the rest basically all flows through to the team. So there's no cost to the team.
Do you vet the teams in any way? How do you ensure that it's a real team versus, you know, some nefarious individuals who figure this is a great way to make money?
So first of all, I think it's really important to know that it's all peer-to-peer. There's no random people on the internet coming to, you know, shop to support your hockey team. So, you know, it's hard to drive sales. So it's the parents that are involved within that small unit. So that's one really important part, because it doesn't really fit like a model that would have nefarious kind of activity. But the second part is when your team signs up, the beneficiary or the payment information is going to the team. So we have some systems in place, plus some people basically looking at all the payments to approve all the beneficiaries in the system. So when the check is being cut to the U14 or the 14U synchronized swimming team, right? We know that it's going to the right place. Mm.
What are the other players in Canada that do this kind of thing? I'm familiar with Good Search. I think they've rebranded, but Good Search was around in the U.S., it's been around for like a decade, and it was about charity versus teams. Yeah. So you focus it on cancer or hunger or whatever. What other options do teams have here? Is this a crowded space?
It's indirectly crowded. So there was a lot of really interesting tools that were trying to kind of go after, you know, existing digital marketing spend for some social purpose or social cause, you know, Good Search being one of them. And we kind of came out of that era as well. It's really hard to basically scale those programs and get enough users to make it relevant for the merchants and brands. So really, on the team side of things, from a fundraising perspective, it's still it's still stuck in the Stone Ages. It's still kind of stuck in the 50s. It's a bunch of busy parents, basically, that don't have a lot of time anyways, and they're trying to basically coordinate events from a volunteer perspective and do like fundraising drives. So the market really hasn't evolved with and kept up pace to what you've seen on the crowdfunding side of things. There's some really interesting tools out there for sports parents.
Right.
And we've tried to basically merge the best of the, you know, the parent team fundraising tool sets with basically e-commerce and cashback shopping.
Well, and fundraising is about as enjoyable as the gelling process for us parents with our kids. Do you know what they, I don't know if you have a kid in synchro, but it's actual gelatin you're putting in their hair. It's disgusting, but they do look amazing once it's done.
I also happen to be a busy sports parent with three kids in hockey, lacrosse, track and field, and volleyball.
Yeah.
So, and my lovely wife typically put her hand up to volunteer to become the team manager. So, you know, we saw firsthand how time consuming and how much effort was going into this. And you name it, we've had to do it.
Right. So this business is good for your marriage. This business is good for your marriage. Good for you.
Yes, and if my wife can just do a Christmas shopping online, I don't have to sell raffle tickets to my buddies at work anymore.
Brilliant. Mark, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Mark Bachman is the CEO of FlipGive. It's a new way to raise money, in particular for school teams, that doesn't involve you selling, I don't know, magazine subscriptions. What else do people sell? Time now for the Moolala questionnaire. If you haven't heard it before, it's a series of questions about money, and we pose these questions to various guests in all facets of the financial services industry. Our guest today, Carol Bezaire, Vice President of Tax, Estate, and Strategic Philanthropy at McKenzie Investments. Hello.
Hello.
How would you describe your money personality?
Conservative.
And why do you think that is? Is that your temperament in life, or was there something formative that had that be your personality in the area of money?
I grew up with no money.
Ah. Well, okay, so and why do you think that had you be conservative? Because other people I have talked to who come from humble means really believe that they work hard and they live in a world in which they deserve the finery and they're willing to take risks because it can't get any worse than it was.
Mm-hmm. Well, I grew up with a large family and one working parent, and we were taught to save for a rainy day.
How many kids?
Eight.
And where are you in the birth order?
Four.
You're number four. You're right in the middle. Are you a good mediator?
Yes, I try to be. Absolutely.
The middle kids. I'm the youngest middle. Of five. There's nothing mediating about my personality. It's all about trying to get attention. Who would you say was your money mentor growing up?
My money mentor actually was my mother.
Interesting. And what do you think you learned from her?
I learned how to stretch a dollar further than you would think it could stretch and always have something put in the closet in case something came up. So it was always planning for the unfortunate and hoping it doesn't happen.
You now are very successful in your work. You don't need to stretch the dollar in the same way that your mom would have. But what are some habits that you can't or won't shake when it comes to stretching a dollar? I'll tell you one of mine. I still rinse and save Ziploc bags.
Which people just
roll their eyes about, especially those friends of mine who work in the food industry, like, that's unsanitary. But I make sure there's never been anything perishable in it. But if it had crackers in it, I'm going to rinse it out and use it again.
Well, exactly. I actually wash them with the dishes.
Right.
So I do that too. I also gravitate automatically if I go to a store to the sale rack.
Yes. Yes.
I like bargain shopping.
Yes. What are areas that, so grocery shopping, what are areas that you still care a lot about? And maybe you and I are the same. I care a lot about what I pay for groceries, and other areas that you care less about, you're less engaged in when it comes to your money.
I think I'm less engaged in debt repayment anymore because I took care of all of that.
Yeah.
So I do watch the debt. But also, I think I don't care so much about holding on to the money. I prefer to share it with other family members if
right,
I can.
Right. What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures? I'm assuming you have at least one.
I do. I have more than one.
Yeah. Okay. What's one or two?
I like to go for mani-pedis.
Yes.
For one thing. And I like to get my hair done at least like every month or 2 months.
Right. Some of our listeners would be like, that is not a guilty spending pleasure. That is a necessity. That's a necessity. When do you plan to retire? And I'm using air quotes when I say retire. And what will you do?
Given it a lot of thought because I'm on this project. So I would like to retire hopefully by age 65.
Yeah.
And because I'm in Toronto, what I want to do is go to baseball games in the middle of the afternoon and not have to worry about missing work.
Or having to take a client so you can somehow justify
it. Exactly.
If you could snap your fingers and change one financial behavior in society at large, what would it be?
Overspending for things that they don't need. I always talk about that need and want. So if you look at spending on technology, it's almost like a fever. Every time a new phone comes out, you have to have that.
Yeah.
That's like, well, you know, make your money work for you and, of course, enjoy it, but make it work for you too.
That's great. Carol, thank you for your perspective and your honesty. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Bruce. Thank you for the time.
Carol Bazaire, Vice President of Tax, Estate, and Strategic Philanthropy at McKenzie Investments. That was the Moolala Questionnaire. And that is our show for today as well. Don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter. If you go to moolala.ca, scroll down and you can subscribe to our newsletter. Listen, I put out a monthly thing where I bring together content from Prosper, the financial advisor podcast that I host, this radio program, CityLine, CBC, all that kind of stuff. If you're looking for some books to help with your personal finances, there's tons out there. Go to the library, pull out Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. Or, geez, the list is long. The Wealthy Barber, The Wealthy Barber Returns. So many books out there. Send us a note if you've got thoughts, comments, or questions. ask@moolala.ca is the email address. Hope to hear from you. Thank you very much for joining us and have a great day.